Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of From Cradle to Grave, part of Volume 4 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other distinguished guests at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of From Cradle to Grave. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
The discussion is already underway here at the University of Chicago, so let's join it.
As I looked at the film, I had a growing sense of anger. Anger that that position failed to recognize that the system that was being attacked was necessary in our capitalistic free enterprise system that by its own failure produces poverty and therefore requires governmental intervention in the interest of those people caught in the traps of poverty. So as I sat and looked at the film and as I hear Dr. Friedman's statement, I was aroused to the point, as I said, of anger, because only half the story is told. We are really blaming again a victim, this time a system, the welfare system, for the failure of other systems to operate in the interest of people.
Let's get other reactions now to that statement. Trying to do good with other people's money simply has not worked. The welfare system is rotting away the very fabric of society. Tom Saul.
My reaction was just the opposite. My anger was at what had been created in a city where I grew up under very different conditions, during the period of capitalistic failure, during the period when there wasn't this humanitarianism, and where it was possible for people to live better and to get out of that poverty. Now, I think someone living in the very same place where I live would find it much harder to escape from that poverty because of all these things. Buildings were not abandoned like the buildings that we saw in that film when I lived in Harlem. The crime rate, all the things that are blamed upon the failures of the previous method did not exist. I slept out on the fire escapes in Harlem. I would defy anybody to do that in any part of New York City today.
Traditionally, in the United States, we have tried to avoid some of the welfare trap that was referred to by denying eligibility to people who are able-bodied and not aged and so on. And we have therefore tried to close the welfare door to a good number of categories within the poor population. The second point that was emphasized, and I think needs to be put in some perspective, is that some but not all of what we might call welfare programs broadly have this very strong take-back of benefits as you earn some more money. And that, I guess, is what I would like to single out as the principal problem identified in the film, but it is not common to any and all welfare programs that one might think of.
When the family fails, when the private sector fails to create jobs at a fast enough rate, you find that people are unemployed and drift into needing help in order to exist. And the welfare system was created in the 30s. To do exactly that. When the private sector essentially failed, we have the development of a welfare system. It is not corrupting society, it is taking what society institutions have left behind. The family breaking up, the economy not expanding fast enough, the health system failing, the educational system not doing its job. We have untrained, unskilled people looking for jobs in a highly technical society, or jobs that pay so low that people cannot, in fact, live in a decent level of humanity. I see the welfare system not corrupting, but in fact taking the remains and attempting to help people live in dignity.
So rotting away the fabric of society is not supported, except perhaps by you. Would you back that phrase?
Absolutely.
So?
Yeah. You're talking about the failures of the other parts of society. What the welfare system and other kinds of governmental programs are doing is paying people to fail. Insofar as they fail, they receive the money. Insofar as they succeed, even to a moderate extent, the money is taken away. This is even extended into the school systems, where they will give money to schools with low scores. Insofar as the school improves its education, the money is taken away, so that you are subsidizing people to fail in their own private lives and become more dependent upon the handouts.
We have expectations built in today about the quality of life, the quality of job, the level of income for which one expects in return. Why? Because we look at the level around us that it takes us to have
a fairly decent level. No, that's not why. I may have all sorts of expectations. The question is, what can I do? If someone else is subsidizing my expectations will be far higher. Insofar as the Center for Advanced Study was subsidizing my expectations a few years ago, I refused to work at UCLA for the normal full professor's salary. Why should I when I can get the same money for being at the Center for Advanced Study with no hours, no duties, and no classes?
Let's look at another proposition in Milton's case, the insidious effect on those who receive welfare. They lose their human independence and dignity, are treated like children, and so on. Now, Dr. Dumpson, as a former administrator of a major program, is that a great hazard?
That is not a great hazard. As a matter of fact, that presumes that people get on welfare, stay on welfare, and therefore have the result that Dr. Friedman's statement issues. The fact of the matter is that in our AFTC programs throughout the country, and particularly was this true in New York, there is a turnover of the welfare AFTC roles. About a third of them go off each year. Now, if these people were so destroyed by the system, when they go off, they wouldn't go into employment, they wouldn't hold employment, they wouldn't stay off the rolls for 6 months, 18 months, 24 months, as long as they are able to stay off. So there's something wrong with that argument when one looks at people and what they do. People, you know, who are poor are no different from those of us who are not poor. And their motivation for self-dependency, self-support, and mobility in the economic scale is no different than those of our, than the motives we have. So that they will not let the system. You remember, Dr. Friedman, the welfare rights organizations who refused to let the system squelch them down as it was attempting to do. And you we and turned the policies around.
You and I agree completely that the people who are poor and are on welfare rolls are no different from the rest of us. Of course not. They are human beings and they deserve every sympathy and every possibility of making their own way. But the welfare system makes them different.
But you give them
it makes it in their interest to be
how
different.
How do you account for them going off the rolls?
Figures are figures, and you've got to be careful with figures. The fact that a third, there's a turnover of a third, does not mean that there aren't half who are on all the time. People come on, go off, come on, go off. We've got to have the other figure.
The latest statistic, Dr. Friedman,
fraction
is that 34% of the people on AFTC are on for 5 years or longer. And when one thinks of the purpose of the AFTC program, which was the rearing and support of children, dependent children, minor children, I would submit to you that 5 years is not a terribly long time for a mother and children to have to be dependent if there's no other source of income.
I think the other data, we have a program in Pennsylvania for essentially all of those who are not taken care of by the AFTC program. It's called a general assistance program, and there less than 15% are on more than 18 months. So we have a great turnover. We have essentially young males moving into the welfare system after unemployment compensation and then moving out when a job opportunity comes along. This, I think the notion of generations of people on welfare is a very small minority in the whole system. That doesn't mean that the system as presently defined and as the set of programs that we have put together don't often contradict each other. And I'm the first to agree with Dr. Friedman that some of the programs are conflicting. However, I think it is overly broad to say that we turn people into helpless children.
I don't remember talking to anyone who's ever been on welfare who didn't think they were being treated like children while they were on it.
Of course, one must make a difference, a distinction between a system that was set up to help people, and the people who are employed in that system. Look at any public welfare system around the country, and we have practically few trained people to work with people. We employ the ill-trained, people who are not equipped to be helping people. We say they're social workers. They're not social workers. They have neither the skills, the attitudes, and some of them not even the concern. So I think one has to separate out a conceptual framework of a system designed to help people and what the country and community puts into that system to implement those programs.
You mean separate the hopes from the reality?
I separate the skills that are available in order to implement what the objectives of the program are. And I think we have to separate whether we're talking about program objectives or we're talking about how it operates. I would be the first to say that the system that I administered had ill-prepared people to do the job that we were set up to do. But I would not say that the system
that we set up.
I've talked to some social welfare people who think that, in fact, they were so hamstrung by the system that there was very little they could do to help people to get off welfare. That is, to build up skills, get jobs, do whatever was necessary to get off welfare. They felt it was the system.
Bob Lappin, you
well, the system we're stereotyping is one of a great deal of paternalistic interference in individual families' lives. And in fact, isn't this true, Mr. Dumpson? The caseload is so high for an individual welfare worker that they can't do a lot of interfering in individual family lives. Moreover, in the last decade, there's been a real attempt to ease this welfare trap in AFDC by changing the take-back rate and by administering work expenses and child care expenses in such a way as to facilitate work by those who may want to do it. So it's not quite as harsh a picture as we sometimes get, that that there is this omniscient welfare worker who's right there in the living room with the family making all their decisions for them.
I've never heard of a government program which was defective, in which the people who ran it didn't say, if only we had more money to spend on what we're not being able to accomplish with the amount we're spending now.
Milton, I'm going to move on now to some of your prescriptions in that film, because I think it's a good ground for discussion. The most drastic one was when you said, speaking of an unemployed man, supposing you were cruel and took away welfare from this man, he would find a job at some wage. There would always be a job he could get. He might need some charity en route, private charity, but he would get a job. Now, I want you to react, those of you, before we come back to Milton on that, is that a picture that seems plausible to you?
First, he may get a job, but he may get a job in what we refer to as the underground economy. And that's where a number of our youth are now going to get their jobs. Those activities that are illegal, and the only opportunity they have for earning part of a livelihood.
I think the other issue is that you have a whole group of people who are the single female head of a household. And yes, cut off welfare tomorrow. What will they do? What will be their immediate response? At what price to their small children and to their middle-aged children? Yes, they'll get a job. In fact, the statistics show that women, in fact, are the most successful through the Absolutely. Employment program. But what has to supplement that, typically, is the provision of some kind of daycare arrangement. Either the individual woman has to earn enough money to be able to pay privately for her daycare, or in fact she is, quote, subsidized through this insidious, corrupting program, set of programs run by the federal government, which in fact makes her employable and a taxpayer. It's an interesting notion of trying to get people in a productive mode.
Tom Sowell.
It's incredible the way you start the story in the middle, as if there's a predestined amount of poverty, a predestined amount of unemployment, and that the welfare system is not itself in any way responsible
there
for that.
There is a predestined 20% of the bottom half of the population.
I have never, well, nonsense. That's always been true.
There's going to be 20% at the bottom.
with it's also true that 20% of the bottom population doesn't have to be living on the government and ruled by the government. You mentioned, for example, the female-headed household. Many of those, in addition to the grown woman who has all the kids, are teenage pregnancies. There's not a predestined amount of teenage pregnancy. I grew up in an era when people, and particularly blacks, were a lot poorer than today, faced a lot more discrimination than today, and in which the teenage pregnancy rate was a lot lower than today. I don't believe there is a predestined amount of teenage pregnancy, a predestined amount of husband desertion. Gutman has done a study of the black family, showing that this whole notion that the black family has always been disintegrating, that is nonsense. That his studies go up to 1925, the great bulk of black families were intact, two-parent families up through 1925, and going all the way back through the era of slavery. So it is now only within our own time that we suddenly see this inevitable tragedy, which the welfare system says it's going to rush in to solve, but which it is itself a part.
We're talking about a very small group. We're talking about 12% of the families are not intact, are not two-parent families at any one
period.
You mean,
among welfare recipients?
No,
or the
among the public at large. We're talking about 12% of the families. 12%.
That's right.
That's a small number.
But none of those on welfare.
We're still talking about a significant component of the bottom 20% that are the bottom 20%. Whether they are above the poverty line or below the poverty line, they are still the bottom 20%. And the issue is, what is the responsibility of the other 80%, if any, toward those individuals?
Does your program plan to eliminate there being a bottom 20%?
No. but it intends to raise the bottom 20%. So
you're raising them by having more illegitimacy, more unemployment.
That's I'm not making them be them. Have illegitimate children. I hope that's clear.
Oh, I think. Oh, you don't have to do that. You simply subsidize it.
We as human beings don't have a responsibility, but I hope we have a compassion and an interest in the bottom 20%. And I only want to say to you that the capitalist system, the private enterprise system in the 19th century, did a far better job of expressing that sense of compassion than the governmental welfare programs are today. The 19th century, the period which people denigrate as a high tide of capitalism, was a period of the greatest outpouring of eleemosynary and charitable activity that the world has ever known. And one of the things I hold against the welfare system most seriously is that it has destroyed private charitable arrangements which are far more effective, far more compassionate, far more person-to-person in helping people who are really, for no fault of their own, in disadvantaged situations.
I have to disagree with you, though, because I think that the whole notion of private property was excluded. Whole segments of society were excluded from the notion of private property in the 19th century, namely women, idiots, and imbeciles. And so I don't go back to the 19th century and hold that up as any paragon that we would want to replicate today.
Anyway, I want Milton now to come to your major prescription, which I know you don't say is on the agenda for tomorrow, but it lies ahead. That is the negative income tax. And I'm not sure people fully understand how it would work. We can't, I think, go into the details of it, but I'd like to get a reaction around the panel, first of all. Is this a viable approach to the enduring problems of poverty? Negative income tax.
I think it's a viable approach to some part of the problems of poverty. It involves, first of all, cash payments rather than in-kind payments, as I understand it. It involves payments on a non-categorical basis.
What do you mean non-categorical?
That is to say, it doesn't matter whether you're a female-headed family or a male-headed family or whether you're young or old, whether you're sick or well.
If your income falls below a certain level,
it does pay some guaranteed income level for people based on family size, and then it has a take-back rate, which is modest, I suppose, by definition. Now, the question is how many things you want to use that program to replace. How many things you want to replace with such a negative income tax program.
Would you replace everything with, just to clear that point up, would you virtually wipe out the remaining forms of welfare if you got this program going?
Yes, I would not. I think its purpose is precisely to provide a transition between where we are now and where we would like to go. Because I agree with you that given that we've corrupted the people on welfare and gotten them on there, we do have an obligation not to throw them out in the street and put them in the difficult adjustment you've made. We've got to ease it off.
Sure.
And so, but I would want to replace all present welfare programs.
Now let's get reactions to this and we'll come back to you.
Well, I saw some figures recently which said that if you took all the money spent on poverty in the United States and divided it by all the poverty family, you come up with a figure of $32,000 per family. Now, the average poverty family apparently is not getting the $32,000. And so clearly someone in between the Treasury and those families is getting an awful lot of that money. And I think that if you simply eliminated the middleman, as they say in the commercials, that there'd be an awful lot of benefit both to the poor and to the taxpayers.
I'm supportive of the negative income tax concept and the objective of it. I'd like to point out, however, that administratively we have another bureaucracy set up. Somebody has to take into account earnings. Absolutely. Someone has to decide when to pay back that which they're entitled to. There's a time lag between the paying back the earning and the paying back. There are a variety of problems in there that I will be prepared to accept, but I want you to know that government intervention is not going to be eliminated.
The issue that I have is where do children come in? What are their rights under a negative income tax? And are we, by building in a negative income tax, in fact subsidizing the illegitimacy that Tom Sowell is so concerned about?
The major reason it is not feasible today to have a negative income tax is because the present welfare bureaucracy would be out of work. They are the major objectors, as Pat Moynihan then, demonstrated in his book on the Nixon program. The chief obstacle to getting it enacted was a welfare bureaucracy. So that I don't believe these administrative problems, if you got it enacted, would be at all serious.
I think the other assumption under the negative income tax, and it's one that I'm not sure I can buy, is that everybody has a minimum level of understanding about how to spend money. In other words, how to use the marketplace to satisfy wishes. And I, as an economist, could say, yes, we do. everybody from age 4 to 100 knows how to use money to satisfy wants. And that's
but
the,
they don't.
That's the premise.
But they don't. There are all sorts of problems of people who are not going to be able to. But that's a minority problem. That's a problem for private activity and private charity. One thing is sure. They would be spending their own money, and that however knowledgeable you are about how to spend...
They would be spending my money.
They would be spending my money, but it would be one stage less bad. Right now, the welfare worker is spending Mr. A's money to help Mr. C. And there's a big takeoff in the middle, as Tom Sowell said.
The question is not whether people on welfare or on low incomes can all spend their money effectively. The question is, how effectively do they spend it as compared to how effectively the bureaucrats spend it for them? Right. Comparing anything to perfection or to some arbitrary standard settles nothing. The same thing is true in the education area. They're saying, would families be able to select schools for their kids under a voucher system, for example? Well, the question is, could they possibly do much worse than the current bureaucrats are doing in the public school system?
We're going on education in another program. Bob Lamp.
I'm on a quibble with something you said, Tom, about half of the money not going to the poor or something. That doesn't shouldn't lead the viewer to think that all that money is going to the administrators of programs. A lot of what you're talking about goes to non-poor recipients. For example, Social Security as a program pays a roughly half of its benefits to people who otherwise would not be poor. Unemployment insurance pays about 2/3 of its benefits or so to non-poor persons. And those are, in some definitions, welfare or anti-poverty programs. And that's how statisticians come up with this horrendous-sounding discrepancy between the total amount of money spent and the total cash benefits that go to the poor.
Well, I think it's a perfectly valid point, though, because supposedly we were not setting up unemployment mm-hmm. benefits and Social Security in order to keep the affluent affluent.
Well, this goes back to this big philosophy debate we might have. I think it's easy to oversimplify things and say that all of these programs, including the public schools, are there to be of help to the poor and the poor only.
Yeah, but I will
but
say,
let me mention that the negative income tax has some of its impetus in that it would be a way of confining benefit payments to people who are income poor.
Yes,
absolutely. And it would cut out benefits for an awful lot of people who now have expectations that they're going to get them, not in the form of public assistance, but in the form of social insurance, as we use the
an argument could be made for not disappointing the expectations on which people have built their lives for one generation, but not have continued for eternity in order to avoid one generation of transition.
What are the other hurdles to it getting underway? Now, you said, I don't know how seriously, the biggest, almost the only hurdle is the welfare bureaucracy.
No. They're the biggest immediate group of lobbyists that will lobby against it.
Yeah.
The biggest hurdle to getting it over at the moment is that there is no way of constructing a sensible negative income tax system that will not hurt some people. There will be some people who will get less money than they are now getting under it, particularly those in the upper income groups, particularly the affluent who are now being subsidized by the welfare. And they will make it politically difficult for the people to put it into effect. The attempt is to put a negative income tax in effect, which costs less money, is easier to administer, and yet which doesn't pay anybody in the society $1 less than he's now getting. There's no way in which you can construct such a program. But although it's not politically feasible now, the force of history is on its side. It's going to become politically feasible.
Dr. Let's not say that the give the impression that welfare administrators were against negative income tax, the FAP program, for example, as Moynihan says, because they would lose their jobs, for example. Many of us were opposed to it because of certain features in that program. A $2,400 level for a family of four, we were opposed to that. And if one goes down the congressional record, those who testified will be shown to be saying, yes, we're for it conceptually, but we're against this piece and this piece. If you change that, you have our support.
I was in the same position. I first proposed a negative income tax 25 years ago. But I testified against the final version of the Nixon plan. Why? Because the welfare bureaucrats had led them to introduce changes in it, which converted it from a decent, satisfactory negative income tax to one which would have been just as bad as what you now have. Would have been added on top of everything else.
It's
political reality,
that's
but
right.
Political reality changes. And that's the important thing. I want to say one more thing about this this whole problem that we've been talking about. And that is, going back to Bob Lampman's comment, there is one thing that can be said in favor of the welfare program, unaccustomed as I am to saying anything in favor of it. And that is that it is the only social program I know of which at least, on the average, gives money to people who are in lower income classes than those who pay the taxes. Every other welfare program, not only does a lot of money go to the people who are well off, but on the average, the poor are taxed and the well-to-do are subsidized. We in the upper income classes have been very clever at conning the poor suckers at the bottom to pay us nice salaries as bureaucrats and to provide us with nice benefits at their expense. And at least the welfare program doesn't do that.
And what you state with great confidence that it will come, the negative income tax, even though you recognize the hurdles. Why are you so sure it will come?
Because the present system has within it the seeds of its own destruction. There is no way in which a system constructed like the present, in my opinion, can avoid creating more and more social problems. And something is going to have to be done. Nobody has proposed any alternative. So far as I know, there is no effective alternative to the negative income tax. And so it gets knocked down, and it keeps rising, it gets knocked down, and it keeps rising.
Yeah, finally raise the question, though, whether in any modern industrial democracy like this one, it's conceivable the system could be run without a fairly elaborate welfare underpinning of some kind. What do you feel, Ms. Bowman?
I don't think it can be, because I think essentially the welfare set of welfare programs reflect the values of this society, that if it didn't, there would have been revolt long before now. Yes, there are rumblings about its cost, and I think that's primarily a function of rapid rates of inflation eroding real income earning power of the middle class taxpayer. But I think on one level, we wanted to give up the responsibility of caring, the responsibility of day-to-day actual caring. And in a technical, modern industrial society like we have, the tax system and the government system is probably isn't viable alternative. I don't think we're going to get out of it. I don't think you're going to see private charities who can take my money that I am free to give or not give and essentially make a difference in people's lives of any substance on any level.
I don't think that has anything to do with society being modern, technological, or industrial. It has to do with an ideology, and particularly an ideology that is very strong among academic intellectuals and in the media. And I think that as time goes on and more intelligent ideas replace the kinds of vague visions that dominate today, that the political climate will change, and that's the only thing that stands in the way of reform right now.
James Dudson.
I don't think you're going to get rid of the system, but I'm interested in a welfare system. I'm interested in Tom's last statement about academicians and theorists and so forth. We forget that we're talking about people, and we may sit in the ivory tower and talk about whether this system will work and ideologically or ideologically why it won't work. At the same time, there are masses of people outside who are locked out of the system that you and I are part of. And somehow we've got to make sure that those people are taken care of. And the short of not doing it, of course, means that your safety and my safety and the vitality of this government and of our country is at stake. The mayor of the city of New York asked me when we had a strike, what would I do if I couldn't get checks out to people when our workers were on strike? And I said to him after the first month, chaos. And he said, what do you mean? I said, no man or woman in the street of the city of New York, you included, Mr. Mayor, will be safe if we cannot take care of people.
Well, there we leave this discussion and hope you'll join us for the next episode of Free to Choose.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.